Imagine a judge.
Okay.
But not just, you know, the standard archetype of a judge sitting way up high on a bench.
Yeah.
I mean, a real physically exhausted human being.
Right. Someone who has just spent the entire week totally immersed in the absolute heaviest parts of human conflict.
Exactly. We're talking about days filled with just intense legal arguments, the immense weight of life-altering verdicts, and just the sheer emotional drain of listening to the endless clamor of the courtroom all week.
It takes a toll.
It really does. So imagine the gavel finally coming down for the last time that week. It is a Saturday evening. The date is today, Saturday, March 7th, 2026.
Right.
The courtroom is locked, the chambers are dark, and the rush of the week has, well, it's completely fallen silent. And I want you to ask yourself, what does a legal mind, a mind rigorously trained to parse right from wrong, order from chaos, what does that mind think about when the noise finally stops?
It's a really compelling image to start with, because in that specific kind of silence, the mind of a seasoned jurist doesn't just turn off and go watch television.
Right. They don't just clock out.
No, it tends to zoom out. It stops looking at the micro, you know, the individual cases, the specific contractual disputes or criminal sentences, and it starts looking at the macro.
The big picture.
Exactly. It looks at the very architecture of the world we've built. And that is really the core mission of our deep dive today. We are exploring the architectural blueprints of a society that actually allows human beings to flourish. And we're doing this based on a really fascinating piece of source material.
Okay, let's unpack this. We are diving into a text titled The Bedrock of Flourishing, A Jurist's Sabbath Reflections. And this was written by Justice Dr. Theophilus Tai-Tazi.
Yes.
And the central tension he's wrestling with here is, I mean, it's arguably the most urgent question of our modern era. How do we prevent humanity's greatest secular achievements from being used for evil?
It's the ultimate question right now.
It is. We are talking about monumental advancements here. Artificial intelligence, advanced theoretical physics, incredibly complex global financial markets.
Staggering achievements of human intellect.
But they simultaneously carry this massive risk of authoritarianism, extreme exploitation, and just systemic destruction.
Right. And what makes Justice Tazi's reflections so uniquely structured is that he doesn't take a Luddite approach to this problem.
He's not saying we need to smash the machines.
Exactly. He doesn't reject our secular tools or suggest we return to some agrarian past. Instead, he blends the rigorous structural logic of jurisprudence with the concept of the laws of creation.
Yeah.
Specifically, he looks at the regulative teachings of Christ to act as a moral safeguard, a governor, if you will, for our secular achievements. We are going to examine how he lays out the ground rules for a flourishing future, one that actually secures our collective well-being rather than actively threatening it.
I want to start exactly where the justice starts his reflection, which is with a very relatable human instinct, the urge to organize, rank, and categorize the world around us.
Oh, yeah, we all do it.
Tazi admits his legal mind is trained to establish order. So, sitting in that Saturday quiet, he first attempts to create a purely secular hierarchy of values.
He tries to build a society on paper.
Right. He tries to conceptually build a functioning society using only the tools of human logic. And at the very summit of this pyramid, he places mathematics, physics, and logic.
Hard sciences.
He considers these the pure disciplines that produce reliable, objective knowledge, the absolute granite foundation of civilization.
Which, if you think about it, is a completely rational starting point for a secular framework. If you are looking for objective truth that transcends cultural or political boundaries, you look to math and physics.
Because gravity is not a partisan issue.
Exactly. The laws of thermodynamics do not care about your demographic. So he places those right at the top. Then, moving down to the middle tier of this secular hierarchy, he places psychology, which he views as the essential tool for understanding the human heart.
Makes sense.
Alongside psychology, he places money, but treating it strictly as a neutral instrument of exchange. He also groups religion and artificial intelligence into this middle tier.
Which is wild.
It is. He describes both of them as powerful streams that can irrigate or flood.
Wait, let me stop you there. Because grouping religion and AI together in the exact same tier is a really provocative choice.
It definitely grabs your attention.
But the metaphor actually works perfectly. Both of them are massive, emergent streams of power. They can irrigate a crop and feed a whole civilization, or they can overflow their banks and drown the entire valley.
That's a great way to put it.
And then, rounding out this initial secular list, down at the very bottom, he places what he categorizes as the poisons.
The societal rot.
Yeah. These are the destructive forces. Tribalism, nepotism, racism, narcissism, and war. He identifies them as the rot that basically collapses the pillars of any civilized order.
So if you step back and look at that list, math and physics at the top, psychology, AI, and money in the middle, and the societal poisons at the bottom, it seems like a highly functional, logical way to organize human endeavor.
It makes complete sense on paper.
It really does. But this is where the text pivots. Because in the quiet of his reflection, Tatsy realizes this initial list is fundamentally flawed.
What's fascinating here is his analogy for why it's flawed. It's just brilliant. He realizes that a hierarchy of values, without an ultimate transcendent source of authority, is essentially like a court without a constitution.
Right.
Yes, it has rules, it has a structure, it has a judge, it has procedures, but it has no bedrock. There is nothing to ultimately legitimize the rulings.
It's hollow at the center.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He recognizes that his secular list is a hierarchy of utility. It ranks things by how useful they are. But it is not a hierarchy of foundation. It doesn't answer the question of where value itself actually comes from. I want you to think about that in your own life. Do we often prioritize tools like logic and money without asking what foundation they actually rest upon?
Hierarchy of utility tells you what tools work best, but it doesn't give you a single reason to use them justly. And this brings us to a massive paradigm shift in his writing. This is the moment he introduces a theistic worldview.
But we need to clarify how he does this.
Yes, we have to be very careful to observe how he introduces it, because he doesn't bring in the concept of God to compete with or replace his secular list of math, physics, and logic.
He doesn't throw the science out.
Not at all. He brings it in to anchor them.
Right. And within Tatsy's framework, he argues that the staggering precision of mathematics, the unbreakable laws of physics, the very logic that structures human thought, these are not human inventions. They are discoveries.
And that distinction is the absolute linchpin of his philosophy. If mathematics is merely a human invention, well, it's just a conceptual tool we made up to serve our needs. It's no different than a specialized wrench.
Just a really complicated wrench.
Exactly. But if it is a discovery, it implies it was already there. As the justice writes, it is the rational grammar built into creation. It is the fingerprint of a divine architect.
I have to play devil's advocate here, though. For a listener coming from a strictly secular or atheistic background, framing advanced mathematics or quantum physics as divine fingerprints, that might seem like a massive, unnecessary leap.
I completely understand that perspective.
Historically, hasn't the advancement of science often been viewed as being in direct conflict with religious frameworks?
That's a very fair critique, and to be clear, it's a tension the text itself acknowledges. But Tatsy points to a specific historical reality regarding the founders of modern science, figures like Newton, Kepler, and Galileo.
The heavy hitters.
Right. Now, whether modern society shares their faith or not, those specific individuals did not study the natural world to disprove a creator. They studied nature to map what they genuinely believed was God's handiwork.
He saw it as an act of worship, almost.
Exactly. They view their scientific breakthroughs as thinking God's thoughts after him. So Tatsy isn't demanding the reader to dock a specific theology just to do a math equation. He is arguing that viewing these secular disciplines as discoveries of a pre-existing order fundamentally changes our posture toward them.
It changes the vibe completely.
It replaces technological arrogance with a profound sense of reverence.
That makes total sense. It's about the posture we take when we wield the tool. If you view the laws of physics as something you invented, you are the master.
Right.
But if you view them as fundamental laws of creation that you were just fortunate enough to uncover, you are a steward. You're a caretaker. But having a foundation is really only half the battle here. Because once we possess these incredibly powerful discoveries, once we map the human genome or split the atom or build massive neural networks, we still have to decide what on earth we are going to do with them.
Which leads directly into his deep dive on the danger of our tools and the absolute neutrality of power. The overarching theme of this section is that humanity's creations are entirely neutral.
Just sitting there.
Right. A tool sitting on a workbench is completely idle. It is the moral framework of the human being picking up the tool that determines whether the outcome is a blessing or a catastrophe.
And the text doesn't shy away from the harsh realities of this dual-use dilemma. Tatsy vigorously breaks down the specific examples. Look at the pure disciplines of physics and math. With those tools, an engineer can design an incredibly resilient bridge that connects two historically isolated communities. It fosters trade, connection, and peace.
a beautiful application.
Or using the exact same mathematical principles, the exact same equations of trajectory and force, they can design the guidance system for a ballistic missile meant to level a city block.
The math doesn't care.
It really doesn't. A brilliant mind can use their understanding of biology to cure horrific disease. Or they can use that exact same knowledge to synthesize a chemical weapon.
The tool itself has absolutely no preference. And Tazi applies this neutrality specifically to artificial intelligence, which he accurately describes as an emergent power.
AI is definitely the test case for this right now.
AI is perhaps the ultimate test of this dual-use dilemma in our time. On one hand, it has the massive capacity to liberate. It can handle massive amounts of logistical data to optimize global supply chains. That means ensuring food gets to drought-stricken regions faster. It could even assist a judge in parsing through decades of dense case law to find a precedent that exonerates an innocent person.
But on the flip side, without a moral governor, that exact same AI architecture can be used to violently oppress.
Yes.
It can be utilized by authoritarian regimes to enact total surveillance states, crushing dissent, dominating the less fortunate. It can be used to algorithmically manipulate global markets or generate targeted disinformation that just tears the social fabric apart.
He even applies this neutrality to money. Now, in his initial secular list, he viewed money simply as a medium of exchange. But in this deeper analysis, he calls out the corrupt view of money. He specifically mentions the exploitative mindset of Yahoo boys.
Which is a colloquial term used to describe internet fraudsters, right?
Yeah. Exactly. To them, the internet and the financial system are not tools for mutual beneficial exchange. They are weapons. They are used to extract wealth from vulnerable victims through deception.
The system is just a hunting ground.
Right. The digital banking infrastructure isn't inherently evil, but the moral vacuum of the person wielding it creates systemic evil.
If we connect this to the bigger picture Tazi is painting, he is basically diagnosing the core crisis of the modern age. Our problem is not a lack of technological advancement.
We have plenty of that.
We have tools that would look like literal magic to someone living just 200 years ago. Our crisis is a catastrophic lack of a moral framework robust enough to govern the tools we've built. Knowledge without wisdom, as he puts it, is a sword in the hand of a child.
And that is a terrifying image when the sword is artificial general intelligence or global financial derivatives. When these incredibly sharp secular tools are left unguided, or when they are guided solely by the pursuit of utility, efficiency, and profit margins, the inevitable results are exploitation and the degradation of human dignity.
Because the system just optimizes for the strong at the expense of the weak.
Exactly.
Which forces the ultimate question here. If the tools are completely neutral, and human history proves we are incredibly prone to corruption, what exactly do we use to govern the tools? How do we stop the child from swinging the sword?
This is the turning point.
This is where Justice Tazi introduces his revised final hierarchy. He rebuilds his conceptual society. But this time, the structure is based on dependence, not utility.
Right. In this new blueprint, he places God at the absolute foundation, the ultimate source of truth, value, and objective reality. And sitting immediately below that, acting as the practical moral framework, are the teachings of Christ.
And I want to pause here and really drill down on this because it's the most controversial part of his thesis.
It definitely raises eyebrows.
If I'm reading this through a critical lens, injecting religion into governance or societal structures is exactly what causes authoritarianism in many parts of the world.
History is full of those examples.
Right. So how does his text account for the dangers of a theocratic mindset? And to be clear to you listening, we're just imparting the source material here. We aren't endorsing a specific religious view, but we need to understand his mechanics.
It's a crucial distinction, and Tazi navigates it very carefully. Within his framework, he is not talking about religion as a tribal identity.
Okay.
He is not advocating for a specific church to hold political power, nor is he talking about leveraging religious affiliation to gain an in-group advantage over everyone else. He is talking specifically about the regulative teachings of Christ. He isolates principles like radical love of neighbor, justice, mercy, humility, and peacemaking.
He calls these teachings the regulative principle.
Yeah.
And he uses this incredible metaphor of a gyroscope.
Think about how a gyroscope functions in complex systems, whether it's in a massive ocean liner caught in a hurricane or the navigation system of an aircraft. The gyroscope provides internal stabilization against external forces.
It keeps the ship upright.
It keeps the vehicle from capsizing when the pressure becomes overwhelming. Tatsy is arguing that these specific moral principles, mercy, peacemaking, prioritizing the vulnerable, are the gyroscope for our secular achievements. They are the stabilizing mechanism that prevents the massive, accelerated ship of human technological and economic progress from capsizing into tyranny.
It is a deeply functional application of theology. And for you, the listener, whether you personally share Justice Tatsy's specific theistic faith or not, the brilliance of this text is how it forces us to grapple with its central practical challenge.
Yes.
If you want to prevent AI, stock exchanges, and modern statecraft from being weaponized, you cannot rely on the tools to regulate themselves. An algorithm optimizing for engagement will not suddenly decide to optimize for empathy.
It doesn't have the capacity.
A purely free market will not suddenly decide to prioritize the marginalized over profit. You have to actively impose an external transcendent moral order onto the system.
Exactly. The framework Tatsy presents one that demands radical humility and the protection of the weakest acts as the necessary counterweight to the ruthless mathematical efficiency of modern technology. So, if we look at his newly constructed hierarchy, it's radically different from his first attempt.
Let's walk through it layer by layer.
Yeah.
Number one, God acting as the ultimate foundation.
Right.
Number two, the teachings of Christ, acting as the moral framework and the gyroscope. Number three, mathematics, physics, logic. But no longer just human inventions. Now they are the structural disciplines, the divine tools for understanding the universe.
The discoveries.
Number four, psychology, the map of the human heart. Number five, money, returned to its rightful neutral place as a tool for exchange, actively stripped of the exploitative mentality. Number six, AI, recognized as an emergent power that requires the absolute strongest governance from the gyroscope above it.
It needs the tightest leash.
And finally, number seven, the societal poisons. Tribalism, nepotism, racism, narcissism, war. But they are no longer just sitting at the bottom of the list like an unavoidable foundation. They are identified as weeds that must be actively, continuously uprooted from the garden.
The architecture of that revised list is elegant, because the higher levels actively give meaning, direction, and safety to the lower ones. Artificial intelligence at level six is a profound danger if left to its own devices.
Unregulated AI is terrifying.
But AI, governed tightly by the moral compass of level two, becomes a tremendous force for human flourishing.
But what makes this entire reflection so trustworthy, in my opinion, is what the justice does next. He doesn't just build this theoretical, theological model, declare it perfect, and pat himself on the back.
No, he doesn't stop there.
He immediately stops and engages in a moment of really painful honesty about the reality of human history.
He does. He acknowledges the mixed, often deeply dark histories of both the secular institutions and the religious traditions he holds dear. He writes with total candor that while science has blessed humanity with miraculous cures, it has also cursed us with weapons of mass destruction.
It's a double-edged sword.
And equally, he points out that while the church has historically marched for justice and human rights, there are dark chapters where it has marched alongside oppressors and sanctioned brutality.
Here's where it gets really interesting. He is looking at the bloody pages of history and refusing to look away. He is openly admitting that no human institution, neither the brightest minds in the laboratory nor the most devout leaders in the sanctuary, holds a monopoly on truth.
It is a breathtaking moment of self-awareness, especially coming from a jurist, someone whose literal job description is to sit on a bench and issue definitive, binding judgments on other people's lives.
People literally stand when he walks in the room.
Exactly. Yet he embraces the concept that humility is not merely a virtue, it is an epistemological necessity.
And let's not get bogged down in academic jargon here. Applying that idea of epistemic humility to today's world is so vital. We don't need to define it like a textbook. We just need to look at modern tech.
Look at AI right now.
Think about black box AI models today. We have systems operating at speeds and complexities that even their own creators and programmers do not fully understand. When a system outputs a decision, the engineers often can't trace exactly how it arrived at that conclusion.
They just see the output.
In that reality, arrogance is terrifying.
Precisely. To say humility is a necessity means that because our ability to comprehend the ultimate truth is inherently limited because, as he quotes the Apostle Paul, we see through a glass, darkly, we're logically and practically required to be humble. Arrogance isn't just a character flaw. It is a factual error regarding the limits of human comprehension.
I want you to really think about the era we are currently living in. We are constantly drowning in information overload. We are surrounded by this toxic, hyper-polarized digital environment where everyone is absolutely, unequivocally certain that their political side or their ideological tribe is 100% right and the other side is entirely evil.
It's exhausting.
In that environment, hearing a brilliant legal mind say, "I don't have a monopoly on truth, and neither do you," is like taking a deep breath of fresh air. Intellectual humility is the only logical response to navigating systems as complex as global financial markets or machine learning. Because the moment we become absolutely certain we have it all figured out, that is the exact moment the gyroscope breaks and the ship capsizes.
Which serves as the perfect transition from the philosophical to the highly practical. Because Justice Tozzi isn't just writing theological poetry on a Saturday night for his own amusement.
He has to go to work on Monday.
Exactly. He is actively preparing for his reality on Monday morning. He asks himself the hard question. How does this deeply rooted, humble, morally guided philosophy actually change the legal and societal structures we operate in every day?
How does it change the rulings?
How does this change his behavior when he puts the robes back on and walks into the courtroom? He lays out a concrete blueprint, 4 specific resolutions based on this framework.
Let's spend some real time on this Monday morning blueprint, because this is where the philosophy actually meets the pavement. The very first resolution he makes is regarding human dignity. He states that human dignity is not a grant from the state. It is an endowment from the Creator. Therefore, it is completely non-negotiable.
We really need to flesh out the implications of that because they are massive. If human dignity is merely granted by the state or defined by a tech company's terms of service or determined by your value in a financial market, then it can be revoked by them just as easily.
It's conditional.
Right. If your ultimate value as a human being comes from your economic utility, what happens to your dignity when an AI can do your job better, faster, and cheaper? Under a purely secular utilitarian framework, your dignity plummets the moment you are no longer useful.
You just become obsolete.
But under Tozzi's framework, your dignity is an endowment from the architect of the universe. It is hardwired into the cosmos. No algorithm, no economic downturn, and no authoritarian dictator can ever strip it away.
That drastically changes how a judge views the person standing before them in a courtroom. They aren't just a case number or a liability. They are an endowed creation.
It humanizes the entire process.
The second point in his blueprint addresses the tension between true justice and legal technicality. And I found this point genuinely chilling. He writes that a judgment can be correct in form and monstrous in substance.
That phrase should haunt anyone who works in a bureaucracy. It means you can follow every single rule in the legal code. You can check every procedural box. You can execute the law flawlessly on paper and still commit a monstrous act of injustice. True justice, he argues, has to align with that transcendent moral order, that gyroscope we discussed earlier.
Think about the historical precedents for that. The legal systems that upheld apartheid, or the courts that enforced segregation laws. The judges in those systems were often applying the law exactly as it was written.
They were doing their job.
They were correct in form. But the substance was a profound violation of human dignity. Tozzi is warning himself and warning us never to confuse the scaffolding of the law with the bedrock of true justice. The law is simply a tool. It is entirely neutral. Justice is the moral framework that must guide the tool.
His third point tackles the concept of holding power. He asserts that the legislator writing the laws, the judge interpreting them, the technologist building the AI, the banker managing the fund, anyone wielding these immense secular tools must hold their power with an open hand.
An open hand.
They must exercise their authority with the humility of someone who knows they do not possess the whole truth.
An open hand is such a powerful visual. An open hand cannot crush someone. An open hand is ready to release power. It is ready to be corrected. It is ready to serve.
Now, contrast that open hand with the clenched fist of authoritarianism. When a tech CEO creates a powerful new algorithmic model and believes they alone have the genius and the wisdom to deploy it across society without regulatory oversight, that is a clenched fist.
They think they know best.
When a politician subverts democratic norms to force their agenda through because they are utterly convinced of their own absolute righteousness, that is a clenched fist. Tozzi's regulative teaching of humility actively forces the hand open.
And that leads directly to his fourth point, which fundamentally redefines the purpose of the law. In the typical secular mindset, the law is primarily a weapon used to punish the wicked and maintain order through fear of consequence.
It's very punitive.
But in Tozzi's framework, the ultimate aim of the law is to promote healing. It exists to reconcile and repair the torn fabric of the community.
And he doesn't just leave this as a vague feel-good sentiment. He gets incredibly specific and practical. He actually offers a tangible wish, a prayer, really that courts would mandate the establishment of mediation and arbitration centers attached directly to the judicial system.
Before a trial even starts.
He wants a system that requires parties to attempt genuine reconciliation before they are allowed to proceed with the adversarial, often destructive process of litigation.
Think about what that means. That is the regulative teachings of Christ, peacemaking, and mercy, literally altering the structural pipeline of a modern judicial system. He is trying to engineer a system that defaults to healing rather than punishment.
It's a complete paradigm shift.
And his final point in this blueprint, the idea that seals this entire argument together, it is his declaration of who the most important person in the room is. He says the most important person in the courtroom is not the judge sitting high on the bench with the most prestigious title.
Not the lawyers either.
No. The most important person is the most vulnerable neighbor. The neighbor in need is the center of our moral gravity.
If you take that single principle, the vulnerable neighbor, as the center of moral gravity, and you apply it to our modern secular achievements, the entire trajectory of human development changes overnight.
Let's play that out. If the vulnerable neighbor is the center, how do we design AI? We no longer design it purely to maximize corporate profits or increase user engagement times. We actively design it to ensure it doesn't economically displace or digitally surveil the poorest among us.
Right.
How do we structure the global stock exchange? We regulate it strictly to ensure it doesn't allow exploitative high-frequency trading practices that prey on the financially illiterate or destabilized pension funds. The vulnerable person becomes the ultimate stress test for every single tool we invent.
It's a complete inversion of worldly power structures. The tools of man are no longer used to elevate the powerful. They are bound by a moral framework to protect the weak. And having laid out this incredibly rigorous, practical, demanding blueprint for his Monday morning, Justice Tatsy makes a profound stylistic shift for the conclusion of his reflections.
It's a very beautiful ending.
He moves out of the structured intellectual environment of the courtroom and into the breathtaking natural imagery of his homeland.
It's a really moving shift. We leave the chambers behind. He describes the Sabbath sun slowly slipping behind the old hills of Middle Farms in Limbe, Cameroon. He paints a picture of the last golden light of the day resting on the broad shoulders of a tall African Iroko tree.
It's vivid.
And in that beautiful, vivid, natural setting, a quiet truth settles in his spirit about what human flourishing actually looks like in practice.
He uses this magnificent metaphor of the forest. He writes that human flourishing is not the cry of a single flute, but the full music of the forest. I think we need to really sit with that image for a moment. A single flute playing a melody is beautiful, but it is entirely isolated. It lacks depth.
It's just one note.
In our modern context, perhaps that single flute represents pure, unbridled technological progress. Or perhaps it represents pure economic GDP growth. It is a single note being played very loudly. But true flourishing requires harmony. It requires multiple diverse elements working together in a balanced ecosystem.
And he lists the elements of this harmony so perfectly. He says the music of the forest is made up of the clear river of knowledge, the firm baobab of wisdom, the sharp hunter's fear of technical skill, and the steady earth of moral grounding.
The balance is key.
What I love about this is that the secular tools are still there. The technical skill is represented by the sharp hunter's spear. And let's be honest, you need a sharp spear to survive. You need advanced technology. You need logic. You need robust markets.
You can't just discard them.
But a sharp spear without the firm baobab of wisdom, or without the steady earth of moral grounding beneath your feet, isn't a tool for survival. It's just a dangerous weapon flailing blindly in the dark.
This raises an important question about how we, in our hyper-accelerated, instantly gratified modern world, approach the deep mysteries and challenges of life. Tatsy writes that in the hush of that Cameroon evening, the talking drums seemed to whisper an ancient reminder to him.
I love this part.
They reminded him that the deepest questions of life, questions about meaning, objective value, true justice, and the nature of the soul, are not yams to be peeled quickly by clever hands.
That line stopped me in my tracks. Not yams to be peeled quickly by clever hands. I mean, I'll be the first to admit, I am completely guilty of the clever hands mindset.
I think we all are.
If I have a complex problem, I want a quick fix. I'll ask an AI to summarize a 300-page book for me in 3 bullet points. We live in a society obsessed with clever hands. We want a new app to cure our epidemic of loneliness. We want a new algorithm to solve systemic injustice. We want a new financial derivative to eradicate poverty. We want to peel the yam as fast as humanly possible and just consume it.
But the text is urging us to see that the deep questions of human flourishing are not logistical puzzles to be solved by cleverness or efficiency. They are mysteries. They are like the sacred grove at the heart of the forest. They must be approached slowly, with reverence, and with the deep, abiding humility of someone who realizes that the world is far older than their own footsteps.
We have to respect the process.
We have to realize that meaning, value, and goodness are rivers to be listened to over time. They are forests to be walked with respect. They are wisdom trees whose roots run far deeper than any single generation's technological breakthroughs.
It is a profound, urgent call to slow down. The foundation is laid, as he says, like the first stones of a homestead built on honest ground. The compass is set, pointing toward that crucial intersection of justice, truth, and compassion.
And the reflection ends not with a retreat from the world, but with the anticipation of the new week.
When Monday morning dawns.
When the cock's crow wakes the village, the work isn't to hide from secular society. The work is to build it. To build it with steady hands, utilizing the brilliant river of human knowledge, sheltered by the baobab of wisdom, and strengthened by quiet moral courage.
It is the synthesis of everything he has argued. The jurist doesn't abandon his secular duties or his logic. He returns to them transformed. He returns with the gyroscope fully installed.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean for us? Let's recap the journey we've taken today. We started with a fragile, strictly secular ranking of human knowledge, a hierarchy of utility that placed math and physics at the top but lacked any real bedrock to define value. We explored the paradigm shift of seeing those secular disciplines not as clever human inventions, but as discoveries of the rational grammar of the universe. We confronted the terrifying absolute neutrality of our greatest tools, how AI, financial markets, and advanced physics can build bridges or guide missiles, liberating the poor or empower the tyrant.
The dual-use dilemma.
And we saw how Tozzi proposes the regulative teachings of Christ, specifically the principles of radical mercy, humility, and prioritizing the most vulnerable as the essential gyroscope. In his framework, they provide the moral structure that prevents our secular achievements from capsizing into evil.
And that brings me to a final provocative thought that I want to leave with you, the listener, as you go about your week. We have explored Justice Tozzi's argument that tools like artificial intelligence are completely neutral, and their ultimate impact on humanity is determined entirely by the moral framework of the people wielding them.
The people holding the tool.
But let's take that philosophical concept and drag it into our current practical reality. AI doesn't have a conscience. It doesn't have a soul. It only has the data and the optimization parameters we feed into it.
It only knows what we tell it.
If principles like peacemaking, deep humility, and placing the most vulnerable neighbor at the center of our moral gravity are indeed the true gyroscope for human flourishing, how do we actually translate that into the digital age? How do you code humility into a machine learning algorithm?
That's the million-dollar question.
How do you program mercy into a systemic architecture that currently only understands the language of utility, engagement metrics, and financial efficiency?
That might be the defining challenge of our generation. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Thank you for taking the time to pause, to step out of the relentless noise of the week, and to really think about the architecture of the world we are building. We hope you carry the steady, rooted wisdom of the baobab tree into whatever courtroom, office, or community you find yourself in this week. Until next time.